Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In today's Scholar Circle, we will spend the hour discussing corruption, particularly political corruption, its history, causes, costs to society, and possible remedies. With us are three experts. Paul M. Haywood is the Sir Francis Hill Professor of European Politics at the University of Nottingham in the UK. His books include The Routledge Handbook of Political Corruption and Developments in European Politics. Bruce Buchan is also with us. He is a professor of politics at Griffith University in Australia. His publications include An Intellectual History of Political Corruption from Antiquity to 1800 and The Empire of Political Thought, Indigenous Australians in the Language of Colonial Government. Susan Rose Ackerman joins us. She's a professor of law and political science at Yale University. Her main publications include Corruption in Government, Corruption, a Study in Political Economy, and Anti-Corruption Policy. Can International Actors Play a Constructive Role? Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Susan Rose Ackerman and Paul Haywood. We're waiting for Bruce Buchan to join us. But I thought what we would do as we analyze corruption is really start with, it's a word that is thrown around a lot, but perhaps it's useful to define what we mean when we're saying corruption. How do we know what it is and what it isn't? Susan Rose Ackerman, do you want to start?
I think it's important to think of corruption as a piece of a broader problem, which is the relationship between private wealth and public power, which shows up in a lot of different contexts. I don't want to label all of those relationships corruption. I think the particular things that are corrupt or have to do with somebody personally, financially benefiting or politically benefiting from a financial transaction in which they take money or take some other kind of benefit and behave in a way that's outside of their role as a politician, as a bureaucrat, as some kind of a public servant.
Paul Haywood, would you add anything to that?
Well, yes, I think what I'd add is that whilst what Susan has said is absolutely right, one of the difficulties with trying to define corruption is that on the one hand, it's fairly simple to say, well, corruption is really the abuse of power for private gain, or some people say the abuse of public power or entrusted power. And at that level, sure, that's essentially what it is, but that hides a whole series of different elements, and you get different types of corruption. For instance, you know, kleptocracy, where state leaders steal the patrimony of a state, or extortion, bribery, nepotism, influence peddling, embezzlement, fraud. These are all forms of corruption, but they're very, very different in how they manifest. You get corruption that takes place between two individuals, you get corruption that takes place at sort of national level, you get international networks of corruption, and you get different kinds of corruption in different sectors. You get corruption in bureaucracy, in judiciary, in police, in the construction sector, the health sector, etc. And what tends to happen is that all of these different forms of corruption just get lumped together under this broad generic label of corruption, and that's really unhelpful in terms of getting to understand exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. That another way of saying it is that let's look at what people are getting in return for the bribes that they pay or the benefits that they provide. And it's in a way, it's the incentives that show up in ordinary, often entirely legal dealings in the market, showing up in places where they're not supposed to be showing up. But it's important to understand how to deal with it. You have to think about it in terms of what it is somebody's getting. They're getting a contract. They're getting a lower tax break. They're getting access to some kind of public service they don't deserve. And that's the way to start thinking about reform, is by thinking about it, disaggregating it, as I think Paul was also saying, into different kinds of problems.
I wonder if, Paul, you would be willing to give us real-life examples about some of those different categories of corruption that you were talking about. Where do we see it?
Okay, so let's think about, say, parts of the developing world where you know, levels of poverty are pretty extensive. Maybe government structures are not very well developed. They formally exist, but in practice, they what actually happens doesn't follow the rules of what should happen. And there, for many, many people, ordinary citizens, corruption is a standard way of life. If you want to see health professionals, you have to pay a bribe. If you want to get your kids into school, you have to pay bribes, and that is a standard way that life is lived. In the developed world, in the kinds of societies in which we all live, that kind of corruption is almost never seen. We don't encounter that. Our lived experience is very different. But there are maybe very different forms of corruption going on. So, for instance, you might be getting procurement corruption. So where there's a big government contract that's going out for tender, there may be collusion going on between government departments and particular private sector bidders. That's a form of corruption which exists much more in some settings than in others. And so I think we need to be very specific about what types of corruption we're looking at, in what settings, and what drives it. And so some people draw a distinction between what's called grand corruption or petty corruption, which is a starting point. I think we need to be even more focused on the kinds of different corruption that takes place in different places. What is clear is that whereas in the past maybe we tended to think of corruption as being a problem peculiar to the developing world, and that once we got to a situation in which established democracies were in play, we would see a real decrease in corruption. I think what we're beginning to understand much better now is that maybe it's not so much a decrease in corruption as the emergence of different forms of corruption, different kinds of corruption. And certainly we've seen huge numbers of corruption scandals in the most established democracies over recent years.
Susan Rose Eckerman.
So, you know, just to give some examples, I spent about a week in Brazil last summer, and as you probably know, there have been a lot of recent scandals there that illustrate the sort of high level corruption. Because this is a middle income country, so the kinds of corruption are not so different from what you might see in the U.S. or in Canada or in New Zealand, in that they had to do with big contracts, big construction contracts, in this case having to do with their the national oil company. The good thing about Brazil is they have a very independent set of prosecutors and some very high integrity judges, so that a lot of information has come out about those deals, maybe making Brazil look more corrupt than some other countries where it's actually not more corrupt. The other countries are more corrupt, but they're not as transparent about what is, you can't find out as much about what's happening, or they don't have so many aggressive people. So that's a wide, you know, that the corruption in public procurement is very widespread, and you can understand why it's particularly vulnerable, because these are one-of-a-kind deals. A lot of money is at stake in each one. It really matters if you get it, and there's a lot of discretion within the government to decide who should get the contracts. Discretion which can't be entirely gotten rid of.
You mentioned the independent prosecution of Brazil as part of why we are hearing about it. Put that into a comparison with what's happening in the United States right now. Susan Rose Eckerman, how would you see that in comparison?
Well, I'm very worried about the optics which really matter in the current political situation in the U.S. Because if you think one of the things that I think the anti-corruption movement of the last 20 years has done is change the at least the rhetoric, and I think actually the behavior of multinational corporations in international business. So there's still problems, but at least there is some least fragile agreement that high level corruption is not a good thing, and that it's you're vulnerable to being prosecuted for it. And even though there are statements being made that from the current administration that they will continue to be prosecuting in this area, I'm not at all confident that that's what's going to happen. So there's a worry that something, that a form of behavior that's come about through legal threats of legal prosecution, but also through a kind of an understanding about what's acceptable, may fall apart. There's a special problem particularly with Trump's businesses, in that he has a lot of international businesses in many countries that have been particularly vulnerable, or there have been allegations of corruption. Now, he's distinguished himself for taking himself away from those businesses, but you know, they're still out there with his name on it. And he's organized it so that he probably isn't, that those businesses may not easily come under our Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It's there's a worrying set of experience that he's got, and his businesses have had, that that makes one worried that the anti-corruption agenda will not be carried forward.
Paul Haywood,
can I just add something to that? I fully agree with everything that Susan has said, but we should note and recognize that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act has been very important, and particularly the way that it's been used much more intensively in recent years to chase after corrupt activities that have any kind of involvement with the US, and that's been really quite significant in some of the big corruption cases in recent years. But there are some concerning signs, not least that, you know, we've already seen from the Trump administration some attempts to water down some of the protections against financial misdealing. But also in the UK, it's in the Conservative Party manifesto that the Serious Fraud Office, which has been the UK's main arm in prosecuting corruption, is going to be rolled into the National Crime Agency and brought much more under government control. And that's a really worrying development, as is the increased use of things like deferred prosecution agreements, where the fines that are being levied on companies, and I'm not talking about the states here because I think the FCPA has been used very effectively, but in the United Kingdom, some of the fines levied on companies found guilty of malfeasance have been effectively so trivial that they can just be discounted as almost a price worth paying.
I think one of the other concerns specifically in the United States is also about whether or not the president, being of a Republican Party, the Congress being controlled by the Republican Party, the judiciary kind of controlled by the Republican Party, and then the attempt to sort of color the law enforcement arms or to persuade law enforcement arms to go along with some activities that may or may not be particularly clean. Are these structures being compromised in the United States because of the partisan element? Susan, would you think so?
Well, I mean, maybe we need to step back a few minutes. First of all, there's not much there's a limit to what the current administration can do with respect to the federal courts. I mean, those are lifetime appointments. And although there are a large number of empty seats, which can be filled by the president appointing them and the Senate confirming, and that will move the judiciary in a more conservative direction, not necessarily in the direction against corruption. I mean, many conservatives are very strongly in favor of prosecuting people for misusing funds. So it's not clear how that's going to show up with respect to white collar crime and corruption. But the second thing to notice is that, unlike many other countries, our prosecutors, the federal prosecutors, are political appointees. And Trump asked them all to resign, including in particular the very aggressive prosecutor in the New York City area. So he will be able to appoint people. And if he wants to use those appointments as in a way to reduce any kind of prosecutions of white collar crime, he could do it. Now, it's not clear that he'll do it. I mean, no, that we don't know. We've yet to see exactly what that's going to be. But so the concern is, I think, particularly with what's going to happen with the federal prosecutors, and then maybe over time a worry about the judiciary. It'll depend a lot on the kind of people who are appointed, who may be conservative in the kind of traditional Republican sense, but still quite aggressive on these issues, or will they simply be people who are not? You know, we don't really know about that. So there's a good, it's important to watch it, let's say. And the key point from a comparative point of view is the lack of independence of the prosecutors. Now, I think they're not that, I don't know about New Zealand or England. In some places in Europe, they're, and as I said, Brazil, they're actually quite independent.
Paul Heywood?
Yes, no, well, I think, you know, for those of us from outside of the States who have been watching what's been going on, I think a lot of us feel, I imagine it's true for many in the States as well, that the Trump presidency and the signs of how it started out is, you know, a real test of the kind of Madisonian vision of the democratic checks and balances and you know, what should be in place to ensure that kind of abuse of power can't actually happen. And I have to say that, you know, from the outside, the early signs, you know, if some of the presidential actions have been concerning, equally some of the responses have been to some degree gratifying in terms of actually stopping some things happening.
Like what, for example?
For instance, the travel ban on people from selected countries. That kind of thing suggests that it's not so straightforward, or the responses to, you know, the withdrawal from the Paris climate change talks. You know,
right.
It's clear that, you know, presidential power is certainly not absolute.
Stay tuned. Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we've been speaking with Susan Rose Ackerman, Bruce Buchan, and Paul Heywood about the causes and consequences of corruption. Susan Rose Ackerman?
I wanted to agree that it's important that there's a quite depth of civil society groups in all areas, in both the environmental community is becoming very active, and not just for climate change, but for ordinary pollution, air, water pollution, things that you thought had been taken care of and were pretty set are in play as well. And there's certainly a lot of pushback.
I was just thinking that, Susan, you study a lot of the sort of political economy of corruption and the incentives that are in place and the regulations that are in place to sort of protect from, you know, people enriching themselves from these rules and regulations that either get slashed or get put in place in case of some taxes, tax breaks, that sort of a thing. But, you know, we don't really take into consideration as much when we are talking about corruption, the environmental degradation, which you just mentioned, and the cost of that.
The link back to corruption is a little indirect, right? I mean, there certainly are some examples of mineral exploitation or certain kinds of big investment projects that have been approved as a result of corruption and that end up having a big impact on the environment. And people may pay bribes, of course, in some countries to get out of having to comply with environmental regulation. I mean, but that's true not just particularly about the environment, but any kind of constraint on business and individual action can be a reason why somebody wants to pay a bribe to get out of it.
A couple of other things that I noticed in both of your work. Paul Heywood, let's take a look at a couple of things that you had written. You were writing about, of course, how in democracy it's expected to have certain checks and balances that would help to stem corruption, but that there are certain things that have arisen over time, including the exaltation of the market and deregulation, that have been sort of blurring the lines here. Can you help us understand that?
So I think one of the key developments that has happened over the last 35, 40 years is that whereas in the past we tended to have a very clear separation between what we might call the public sphere and the private sphere, and there was a tendency to believe that many problems of corruption came mainly from people in the public sphere, in holders of public office abusing their positions of power, and we didn't really pay so much attention to the private sector. I think what's happened is that those lines have become increasingly blurred, as increasingly over recent years, as what we might term sort of deregulatory neoliberal approaches to economic management have seen a shrinking of the size of the state as a whole, but more important, a shift away from state delivery of public services towards private delivery of public services, and increasingly private design of public policy. And so that blurring of the distinctions makes lines of accountability more difficult than they used to be. Whereas it was in a kind of a classic separation of powers approach, you could see what the lines of accountability should be and how they should work. In the modern, what some people call postmodern state, those kinds of delineations are much, much more difficult. And so if a private company is responsible for things like the security of prisons and something goes wrong, where is the accountability for that? Who is actually held up to account? And that, I think, has opened new spaces for new kinds of potentially corrupt relationships to take place. And so we're seeing different forms of corruption now emerging in ways mm-hmm. that didn't really exist maybe 35, 40 years ago.
And some of those new forms look like?
So some of those new forms involve the relationships between different providers, where, you know, maybe contracts can be developed and given to particular providers without proper lines of accountability, or where certain standards of, you know, safety standards are abused or misused for particular reasons, or that kind of shift away from the need to give a kind of a public account for what's being done.
Yeah, I guess another way to say basically the same thing is the claim by government contractors that the rules that apply to private firms are what apply to them, that they don't take on some of the character of a public institution through the fact that they're contracting with government. And that means that what they're doing may be much less transparent to watchdogs or monitors or citizens who can't hold them to account because they can't see what's going on.
Exactly.
So in a case like that, where it sounds like the toothpaste is sort of gotten out of the tube, how do you put the toothpaste back in the tube? Is that possible, Susan Rose Ackerman?
Well, I don't see any reason why you can't regulate the behavior of private contractors more effectively than we're currently doing. That's one part of the story. The other part of the story has to do with debates going on about what is it appropriate to move away from the state into private contracts. And Paul mentioned prisons, which is, of course, one of the most vexed and controversial of those cases. And where the argument against permitting private provision becomes stronger if those private firms are not subject to the same kind of monitoring and constraints and public accountability as a public institution would be.
Did I just hear that Bruce Buchan has joined the call?
Yes, I'm sorry. I've joined very late. I've had some technical problems.
That's okay. Well, let me ask, since we've got you, Bruce Buchan, I wonder if we can get a historic context. What is it that we can learn from the historic look at corruption that would help us to make sense of what we see today?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, I think that the history of contest over corruption has many lessons that we can derive. But one that I think is very important is that corruption is a constant source of dispute and debate and contest in across time, and that debate has really revolved around contest over the term itself and what the term involves. So in my own research, I've been interested in the way in which corruption takes on very wide and expansive definitions or understandings, and at different times very narrow and precise understandings around expectations of public officials and so on. But always there is this wider set of connotations around corruption having to do with the health of the polity and its stability over time, its moral claims and so on.
So is this really more of a cultural aspect of what is acceptable, what is not acceptable in terms of the societal norms?
Well, I think that corruption, whatever else it may be in a precise legal sense or in our understanding of the expectations in public office, corruption is a key term in political debate and has been for many centuries. And as such, corruption is often deployed in arguments about the value of political institutions, the stability of the foundations of politics and the political system within society, its spiritual basis or its moral basis. We can't escape these wider connotations. And so I think that we need to bear that in mind whenever we talk about corruption. We're not just talking about a precise narrow understanding about particular forms of activity, whether it be bribery or venality or graft or whatever, but that there is this wider set of understandings around corruption that are very much a part of the Western tradition of political thought and political debate.
One of the things I wonder, and this is partly because of something I read in Susan Rose Ackerman's writing, and this is about the short-term, long-term trending of things that we would consider corrupt. But Susan Rose Ackerman, you wrote about short-term corruption in post-conflict states in one of your pieces. And it started to make me think that maybe it's not one-directional, that sometimes things are really corrupt, but then can be mitigated, whereas in other cases, maybe it just becomes a trend that gets worse and worse. How do we know, how do we mitigate this?
Well, no simple answer to that big question, but it is important to ask whether the form of corruption is one that's building on itself in a vicious cycle. And some of my examples in the post-conflict case were like that. And some of the people who looked in say, the transitions in Eastern Europe, as in Ukraine or some other places, saw that too, where one level of corruption makes people in the next period think, oh, corruption is common. I think I'll be corrupt too. And then you get more and more corruption over time. And those vicious cycle cases are the particularly difficult ones to deal with, because you can't get out of it by a small scale change. You've got to, you know, change the form of government or rewrite the Constitution or do something serious rather than take incremental steps. And it's not always easy to tell which situation you're in, but that's a important distinction between different kinds of corruption.
Can I just comment on that, Maria? Because I think one of the things that has happened in recent years is that we've potentially so highlighted problems of corruption. We've devoted so much attention to corruption through, you know, international conventions, agencies, you know, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, United Nations, European Union, Foreign and Corrupt Practices Act and so on. There's been so much attention devoted to the issue of corruption that in some ways the discourse around corruption has almost voided it of a specific meaning. So corruption just mm-hmm. becomes everything that people are unhappy with. And we've seen across mm-hmm. the world demonstration after demonstration after demonstration where people are unhappy with the governing bodies, the governing parties, their rulers. And demonstrations nearly always now talk about corruption, but corruption as a sort of catch-all term to say we don't like what's happening. Sometimes it is specifically corruption, other times it's just things are not right, we want to change. And I think this is dangerous because what the risk is that you start to lose the force of what it means to talk about corruption. It just becomes, you know, almost a boo word. Everybody's against corruption and everywhere is corrupt. And so if you build that into people's thinking, you know, all politicians are corrupt, all political figures are corrupt, all political right. parties are corrupt, then you've got real problems. I think that really threatens to undermine and damage the capacity to develop political systems which have trust and credibility.
I agree with that.
Which I would say are also mandatory for them to work, some kind of trust and accountability. Susan Rose Ackerman, that's some of the things that you have also been writing about the different types of regulatory systems. You know, Dodd-Frank, I think, was one that you wrote about. Also, the attempt to loosen the Foreign Corruption Act. What is that trend now, and what are going to be, as you see it, the potential ramifications?
First of all, I take Paul's point very seriously. I completely agree with that sometimes corruption is used by people who see some imperfections in democracy or in government, and they want to call every imperfection they see corruption. Well, that's not helpful. There's a lot of different kinds of ones, and you just lose something if you just mush everything together. On the other hand, I think there is a particular worry right now in the United States that commitments to an honest and effective government may be softening somewhat, and that it behooves those of us who care about the future of American democracy to be alive to the possibility that things can be happening that we're going to be very unhappy about. And that's not just corruption. Some of that is deregulatory efforts. It's tax reform that isn't really reform. There's a lot of stuff which it isn't helpful to call it all corruption. It's just things that are, at least to my mind, undesirable developments.
When we come back, we'll talk about the possible remedies of political corruption. Stay tuned.
Somebody sing. Somebody sing. Hello, hello, hello. Somebody. Somebody cries. Why, why? Somebody. Somebody sing. Hello, hello, hello. Somebody. Somebody cries. Why, why? Somebody sing.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In today's Scholar Circle, we will spend the hour discussing corruption, particularly political corruption, its history, causes, costs to society, and possible remedies. With us are three experts. Paul M. Haywood is the Sir Francis Hill Professor of European Politics at the University of Nottingham in the UK. His books include The Routledge Handbook of Political Corruption and Developments in European Politics. Bruce Buchan is also with us. He is a professor of politics at Griffith University in Australia. His publications include An Intellectual History of Political Corruption from Antiquity to 1800 and The Empire of Political Thought, Indigenous Australians in the Language of Colonial Government. Susan Rose Ackerman joins us. She's a professor of law and political science at Yale University. Her main publications include Corruption in Government, Corruption, a Study in Political Economy, and Anti-Corruption Policy. Can International Actors Play a Constructive Role? Bruce Buchan, you've actually said that corruption tends to be really the norm. Why do you think that?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm necessarily arguing that it's the norm, but I was just very interested to listen to that exchange of views. From a historical point of view, I think that debate over having a precise understanding of corruption in opposition to a more general one, I think can cut both ways. So, for example, in 18th century Britain, it was quite common for corruption to be used and thrown about in political debate between Whigs and Tories. Whenever one particular faction was in opposition, they would accuse the other of being entirely corrupt. And then once they got into office, they would employ the same techniques of government. And so corruption really was almost leached of meaning. It was just this term of debate or abuse. But on the other hand, you've got a figure like Niccolo Machiavelli, who also believed that corruption was the norm rather than the exception, and that corruption should be used to describe a whole range of activities that had a distorting effect on government within Florence. But he argued that that's not a problem. We need to have that awareness of the ubiquity of corruption in order to manage it appropriately. Of course, the way in which he thought it should be managed wouldn't necessarily conform to the standards of a modern 21st century democracy. But nonetheless, he employed a fairly general and pervasive notion of corruption in order to argue that this is a fact of politics that we need to be constantly aware of. And I think that there's something in that attitude that is worth taking very seriously, because I think the effects of thinking that corruption is a very precise set of misdemeanors or crimes and that they can be precisely defined and monitored and eliminated from politics gives rise to a great complacency that we've certainly seen in Australia in recent years, where it would be hard to argue against the proposition that what we're living through at the moment is a new golden age of corruption. We've had a whole series of quite prominent issues bubbling up in our political system involving foreign donations. There's a big debate here about the influence, for example, of Chinese money flowing into both sides of politics here, but also a range of quite prominent cases of senior public figures. There are one particular case of the Lord Mayor of probably the second largest city in the state of Queensland, who was recently detained at an airport with $50,000 on his person, and his lawyer is in fact arguing that he was simply couriering the money from one state to another for one of his clients, which is certainly not an illegal act, but it's a highly improbable line of extenuation. There are these kinds of cases that are coming to the fore that I suspect that if we took a closer look, we would find much more corruption than most people would think in our political system.
Paul Heywood, what do you say to this argument?
So I think it's absolutely right to say that the way that the understanding of corruption has changed over time shows, you know, elements of continuity in its use as a weapon of attack against opponents, and that's always been true. I think the difference now is the ubiquity of the term, and of course we live in a world which is much, much smaller than it ever used to be, in which communications technologies work in different ways. And one of the real concerns, which I think there's increasing awareness of, is what we might term the betrayal, a betrayal of the democratic transcript, in the sense that, you know, democracies to work effectively depend on certain constants. They rely on things like losers' consent, but also the idea that there's a free and fair playing field. That's why we have regulations on things like the amount of money that can be spent by political parties in electoral contests and so on. And that's why there are rules and regulations about who is a fit and proper person to stand for election and so on and so forth. Now, all of that, it could be argued, is coming increasingly under threat from different ways of communicating that didn't exist in the past. And there's been a lot of concern about outside interference in electoral processes. We all know about the stories and the current investigations about, you know, what was the Russian interference in the American election, or indeed in the Brexit debates in the UK. What were the outside interferences in those? But more sinister in some ways is the use by organizations like Cambridge Analytics of social media to get particular messages across in particular ways. And these are real changes to the way that public debate is conducted and the way that democratic processes actually are enacted in practice. And that's where there are real potential risks of corrupting a process. And so whereas some of the acts themselves may not in and of themselves be corrupt in a very precise term, the cumulative effect of it could be seen as potentially corrupting of democracy.
I suppose in the U.S. you could also put the campaign finance system into that category. The lack of regulation around money now, and the Supreme Court essentially saying it's unconstitutional to regulate certain kinds of campaign finance. It sort of legalizes buying access, I would think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Bruce Buchan.
It's been very interesting. I'm very sorry that I joined the discussion so late, but I think one of the issues that comes to my mind when we look at the way in which corruption is used in contemporary debate in democratic nations today is that really a lot of these claims revolve around the corruption of democratic principles and democratic institutions, where you have, for example, the ability of vested interests to predominate in political decisions, or to be able to dominate public debate because of the power of their money. And I think this is a lesson that comes from, again, comes from Niccolo Machiavelli. Whatever we may think of his political prescriptions, his writings on corruption, I think, require us to take very seriously this notion that in order to use the term, we need to understand what the value of our institutions are, how they should operate, and that the distortion of the functioning of those institutions does constitute a form of corruption that we should be very wary of, and we should be willing to call out and debate. So I think I take the point that was made earlier about needing to be careful about expanding the notion of corruption, but I still think that there is great value to be derived from taking seriously these figures from the past who engaged with more expansive notions of corruption that required citizens to think very carefully about what kind of community they wanted and what kind of politics they were prepared to consent to.
It sounds like one of the things that is corrupting in what both of you are saying is a particular kind of rhetoric and a particular kind of value that is being put forward that's an anti-institutions, anti-government, anti-regulatory ideology plus rhetoric. Would you say that's part of what's going on, Paul Haywood?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we're at risk of losing is the, in a sense, social contract between citizens and states. And largely that, again, you know, it's a reflection of of a rhetoric that has developed over the last 25 to 30 years, particularly in established Western democracies, and I'm talking really only here of established Western democracies, that private provision is good and public provision is bad. And I think that has undermined some of the core ideas of what the relationship should be between a notion of citizenship and the role of the state qua government. These are really serious and difficult questions where at the heart of the liberal compact, if you like, there is a fundamental contradiction, because for liberal democracies to function, we need active, engaged citizens who are aware of their responsibilities and duties and commitments. But one of the things that we treasure about liberal democracies is the freedom for people to be untrammeled in terms of what we expect them to do. So on the one hand, we want people to be engaged, and on the other hand, we treasure the freedom for them not to be engaged. But what has happened, I think, is that the pendulum has started to swing rather too far, and that's where you start to get the fertile ground for populist movements to rise up. And that, for me, is a real worry. And could be seen as part of what could be called a corruption of the democratic process that we're all going through.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we've been speaking with Susan Rose Ackerman, Bruce Buchan, and Paul Haywood about the causes and consequences of corruption. You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we've been speaking with Susan Rose Ackerman, Bruce Buchan, and Paul Haywood about the causes and consequences of corruption. Where do we go from here? Like, what are the big potential remedies? I know that's a huge question, but perhaps an attempt to address it is really important. Bruce Buchan.
Well, I'm not sure that I have any neat remedies, I'm afraid. I think many of the issues that we've been discussing go beyond simply introducing new forms of regulation or new laws to address a particular problem. I would want to see a much more robust debate, that public debate, political debate, a greater awareness of these kinds of issues, and a willingness to call out these forms of corruption and to address them seriously in a public way. I think in some ways the issue of corruption has this kind of corruption, if we're talking about the corruption of the democratic process, of representative institutions, I think it's gone beyond even the point of the relationship between citizens and their governments, and involves the fracturing, indeed, of the citizen body, as it were. And I think this is one of the implications of the revelations of the Panama Papers, for example, where you have incredibly wealthy individuals and corporations, of course, and businesses making use of laws that have been designed to create loopholes and all kinds of ways of evading paying tax. And that has a profound implication on the kind of life and the kind of public services that citizens that can't make use of those loopholes or don't want to make use of those loopholes are able to enjoy. So I think that when we're talking about the problem of corruption in this broader sense, about the value of democracy and its vibrancy at this point in our history, I think it behooves us to think also about the way in which corruption doesn't just affect government and public officials. It's also about what citizens are doing and what corporations are doing. And there is, I think, a tendency to think of corruption solely as it relates to public officials. But there is, of course, this other whole area of activity of companies, of business people, and corporations, multinational corporations and domestic corporations that are engaging in activities that do have a weakening and degrading effect on the value of public life within democratic societies.
This is sort of the fundamental crux of democratic societies, being this notion of being politically equal and having the rule of law apply equally across. And it sounds like what you're saying is that foundation is troubled.
Yeah, I think so. And in part, it's about the role of vested interests. We have a very vigorous debate, for example, in Australia at the moment about the capacity of the mining lobby, and in particular the coal mining lobby, that it has over public debate and public policy making, which has tremendous effects on things like our willingness to meet the Paris Climate Accords and other environmental regulations. But it is also about the way in which laws are able to be evaded, escaped, or in some ways the way in which laws are designed with loopholes within them to enable those with the power and with the ability to do so to evade the application of the law in a way that strikes against that very notion, that fundamental notion of equality that a healthy democracy requires.
Paul Haywood.
So if you want my take on how we move forward on this, I think we, in some ways, we need to reset the terms of the discussion. And I think one of the problems with focusing so much on corruption is that it tends to make you look at the negative. And when you look at the negative, what you try to do is find ways to stop it. And when you try to find ways to stop things, the natural response is to always introduce more regulations, more rules, more codes of conduct, more compliance mechanisms, etc. And that in turn breeds a kind of a growing sense of mistrust between those who are responsible for implementing those compliance measures and those who are being made to comply, because essentially we're saying, you know, we don't trust you to behave properly, so therefore we're going to put all these rules in place to ensure that you do. I would reset the whole thing and focus much more on, well, what is it that we want to achieve? So look at the opposite of corruption. Look much more at things like integrity, ethical values, at the positive things that we want, and focus on how do we get those? What do we need to do to reestablish that sense of behaving with integrity, of being a public servant, of ethical climates, of corporations behaving as they should? Put much more emphasis on that as a positive way of trying to reset our thinking rather than trying to stop things happening, which I think in some ways gets you exactly into the vicious circle that Susan was talking about earlier.
Are there examples in history where societies that had fallen down the vicious circle that we've been talking about of corruption have been able to restructure themselves into ethical societies?
Well, the classic example that many people point to, of course, is the United Kingdom, where and Bruce was talking earlier about the what's often referred to as the old corruption, which was rife in late 18th century, early 19th century British political life. And what you got there was in a sense a reset, particularly in regard to the relationship between the landed aristocracy and its attempts to preserve and protect its interests. And the emerging democratic structures of a parliamentary system of government, which was being threatened by that. And so there you did get a shift. And one of the ways it was reflected was in reforms within the civil service and a very, very strong sense of public service. And the United Kingdom became, in some senses, famous throughout the world for the strength of that notion of public service and the nature of the relationship between civil servants and governments and that citizen trust of the way that the system worked. That, of course, has come under increasing threat itself in recent years. But other examples would include some of the Nordic states where, you know, deeply embedded, entrenched corruption was got rid of from the system by, you know, what Boo Rothstein would call a big bang approach. You get a real shock to the body politic, sometimes through defeat in war, where people say, well, you know, something's gone wrong. We need to look at this again. And what's interesting about many of these cases is that the reforms that were introduced were not specifically anti-corruption reforms or anti-corruption laws. They were much more about deepening, defending, establishing democratic process. And, you know, Michael Johnston, who's a really leading scholar of this question, of the whole issue of corruption, talks about the importance of deep democracy as the strongest defense against corruption.
Okay, final word, Bruce Buchan.
I would just endorse those comments wholeheartedly. I think that this is really the key lesson, that corruption is a problem we can do something about, and societies through history have tried to tackle corruption in a variety of ways. But I think our best hope lies precisely in strengthening democratic values and commitment to those values across government, but also across the whole society.
Perfect place to end. Thank you, both of you, Paul Haywood, Bruce Buchan, and then Susan Rose Ackerman, who had to leave a little bit earlier. I deeply appreciate your time and your scholarship on this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
Paul M. Haywood is the Sir Francis Hill Professor of European Politics at the University of Nottingham in the UK. His books include The Routledge Handbook of Political Corruption and Developments in European Politics. Bruce Buchan is a professor of politics at Griffith University in Australia. His publications include An Intellectual History of Political Corruption from Antiquity to 1800 and The Empire of Political Thought, Indigenous Australians in the Language of Colonial Government. Susan Rose Ackerman, she's a professor of law and political science at Yale University. Her main publications include Corruption in Government, Corruption, a Study in Political Economy, and Anti-Corruption Policy, Can International Actors Play a Constructive Role? And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.